Welcome to the Buddha Nature Project, a Tsadar Foundation initiative. In this interview, Klaus-Dieter Mathis, the head of the Department of South Asian, Tibetan, and Buddhist Studies at the University of Vienna, talks with us about his personal interest in Buddha Nature teachings and his ongoing and detailed research projects on the subject. This is the complete recording of the interview. To find short clips on specific topics and explore the world of Buddhism through the teachings on Buddha Nature, visit our website at buddhanature.sadra.org.
You know, in East Asia, you have a critical movement. Mm-hmm. They think, you know, Buddha Nature is not part of the genuine right. Buddhist teaching right. because it's too close to Advaita Vedanta, you know, right. and non-Buddhist thought.
Right.
So, like, this is what I responded to them, you know, like, so either, well, you have to accept like a Buddhahood, you know, otherwise you're not a Buddhist.
Right. Yeah.
And if you don't accept Buddhahood, okay, we can finish the conversation also. You know? That's fine. We can go and have a beer, but we talk about something else, right?
Right.
but if you accept Buddhahood, you know, you have to explain how you attain it, you know.
Right. Right.
Exactly.
Interesting. So again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Klaus. And it's an honor really to talk to you about this because I know you've been studying and publishing on Buddha Nature for many, many years now. So you're really a leader in the field. The first question we have for you really is a broad question about what exactly is interesting or important about Buddha Nature teachings in Tibetan Buddhist thought? That is to say, can you contextualize the importance of the idea of Buddha nature within Buddhist thought?
Well, I mean, Buddha nature has controversial points, like you're already a Buddha and all the qualities are present. And, you know, like there's this notion of permanence and even Atman, you know, like the Dhammakaya has the quality of an Atman of permanence and joy, you know, like and purity. So of course this poses a problem. How can you maintain, you know, like a permanent self, you know, which is blissful and full of all qualities without becoming a Hindu, you know, like, or a theist. Yeah. So like, on the other hand, you know, like describing a Buddhahood and Buddha nature is something really essential for Buddhists. And to look at how like a Tibetan master describes Buddha nature or deals with it is for me a touchstone to compare different doctrines and methods of interpretation. So like just to ask the question, oh, how do you like interpret Buddha nature? Or how do you like take this problem, you know, of a permanent blissful self? And the way, you know, it is interpreted says a lot about a doctrine.
Right.
So that's why I got interested, you know, apart from, you know, like being an old disciple of Kempo Tsultim Gyamso and, you know, was always teaching Shen Tong and was also teaching the Maitreya works, you know, so I was naturally inclined, you know, to these studies also, of course. Yeah.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Do you feel like he influenced you a lot in terms of what you decided about Buddha nature, or do you think you went in a different direction?
No, I think, you know, like I'm still very much in this initial like phase, you know, like just personally or spiritually.
Mm.
I'm still very much inspired by Kempo Tsultim Gyamso, you know, like this practical approach, you know, like he was not only lecturing, but he told you, look, you know, like you should perceive Buddha nature, you know, in every sentient being or, you know, like in the practical like situations, he gave you also this advice. You approached him with a problem, you know, like for example, you know, like in class they challenged me that everything is mind only, and you know, like that there's a Buddha. Well, he said, well, in this situation you have Dhammata too, you know. In this situation, you know, like you're also dealing with colleagues who have Buddha nature, you know. So see, well, he was always, you know, bringing it to a down to earth practical like level. Mm-hmm. And this I liked very much always. Yeah. So for me, it's something related also to like personal experience and meditation practice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you look at like how things are explained in the Kamakaku tradition, you have this like negative intellectual approach of Nagarjuna, and then you have this positive approach, you know, like by Saraha. And Gülözsava also nicely explains it. He says, well, the ultimate reality is only one, you know, but you know, depending on how you approach it, whether you analyze in a philosophy class, you know, with a dualistic mindset, which only analyzes and which only has dualistic objects, you know, then you have to deconstruct, then you have to negate, you know, there's nothing else you can do because, you know, you're not beyond duality. So if you teach Buddha nature in a philosophy class or to somebody who is in a dualistic mind frame, then you will have reification, superimposition, and a wrong understanding of Buddha nature. Then you cling to something external, and that's of course wrong, you know. And then, you know, what is left over is then, you know, a state which is free from wrong reification and wrong denial. But you are not allowed to talk about it. It's not nihilistic. You know, there is something left, but you can't tell them that there's something left. Otherwise, philosophers will be confused, you know, because they will reify it.
Yeah.
So that's one thing, you know. And then you have Saraha and the Doha tradition and, you know, the Mahamudra tradition. And they work with direct experiences, you know, of the true nature of mind. And then, you know, you can say, well, it is beyond words. It cannot be defined. But look, you know, we can use language to try to communicate, you know, can be experienced directly. And then, you know, you say, well, it's luminous, it is a Buddha nature, even though, you know, it's not something which can be defined as a Buddha nature or as luminosity. It's not the light outside or the light you switch on or something.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor, you know, you try to communicate, you know,
Right. Have you ever tried to explain Buddha nature or some of the related debates to a Western philosopher?
Well, sometimes we do, yeah. But it's always, you know, this is a way how I do it. You know, I say, well, when we talk about Buddha nature, it's something inconceivable. It's beyond word. And but still we try to communicate it. And they accept that, you know. They say, well, you know, philosophy in the West has been also like that, you know. Doing philosophy includes also the realization of what is inconceivable, or, you know, what is the true meaning behind the words. So there's a very fruitful dialogue about that.
But how do you keep that from falling into sort of mysticism and you know, it's almost soft. If we can't describe it, if we can't get clear about what we're talking about, what do we know? How do we know what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, that's the problem, you know. You either have to experience it, and then it's clear, you know, what it means, you know, based on the experience, or, I mean, relying on a realized master whom you trust, you know, you can somehow feel the presence, you know, of his realization, and then, you know, you have to trust in this, you know. I mean, that's what you also find in the Gulama, you know. It says it cannot be even fully grasped by 10th level bodhisattvas. Oh. So you have to, you find in Asanga's commentary, the notion, well, all you can do is just, you have to believe in it, you know. So it's, yeah, in a sense, you know, it is beyond, you know, means of logical verification or falsification, in a sense. But, you know, mystic, I don't like to compare it to a mystic thing, because, you know, mystic comes from the Greek word mien, which means to close one's eyes. But this is not what you're doing, you know. You're opening your eyes, right? I mean, you're opening even a third eye, you know. You're fully aware, you know. You sharpen your awareness, and you know, by just seeing reality as it truly is, you know, you come to expressions like Buddha nature, natural luminosity. So I think it's the opposite of mysticism, in a sense.
That's a good point. So along those lines, is the debate over whether Buddha nature is definitive or provisional still ongoing in Tibetan communities? Are there Geluk or Sakya authors who today consider Buddha nature to be provisional?
Well, you know, like when you read the texts, you know, like there are different approaches to deal with Buddha nature. I mean, if you don't take the Tathagatagarbha doctrine at face value, I mean, either, you know, like you say, oh, it is like just a synonym of emptiness. You know, you have this passage in the Lankavatara Sutra where Mahamati, you know, challenges the Buddha and says, well, you are teaching of a Buddha nature with all like major and minor marks. They are similar, or they are like a heretic doctrine. And so the Buddha says, you know, like, well, you know, like Buddha nature is emptiness, you know. So he equates it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have made use of the word Buddha nature just to like attract a certain group of disciples and not to scare away people who are afraid of emptiness. But he said Buddha nature is emptiness. So like one way of looking at it is saying, well, you know, Buddha nature is just a synonym of emptiness. But then the question arises, you know, how do you understand emptiness? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like when you look at the Lankavatara, it is a Yogacara type of emptiness. It's kind of positively understood emptiness. You have luminous emptiness and things like that. But you know, like what the Gelugpas do, you know, they understand emptiness the way Chandrakirti takes it, you know, as a migak, as a non-implying negation. Right. And then, you know, like if you say, well, Buddha nature is a synonym of non-implying negation, then, you know, you can say it has definitive meaning. I mean, that's what they do, you know. Mm-hmm. And the Sakyapas, they say, or Sakya Pandita and Buddha and Rinchen Drop, they take Buddha nature teaching at face value. They say, well, like it has all the qualities, and but, you know, like this teaching has provisional meaning. So that's two different strategies, you know, to explain away Buddha nature if you want. And yes, of course, they this is what they do, you know. I mean, and they are convinced of that, and they would not accept any other like strategy of interpreting it. Like when you go to a Geluk center and well, this is how they explain it, and you know, like if you stand up and then say, well, but Dolpopa said, or Mikyo Dorje said, well, I don't know. It's, I mean, they don't do what we are doing, you know, like they don't compare different hermeneutical systems. It's not very much appreciated, you know, like by any Tibetan school.
Right.
Because, you know, like hermeneutical systems only work if they are exclusive, you know. So you explain, you know, like why the Buddha gave a teaching with a certain intention and why it is provisional, and then you have to really follow that and accept it. Now, if you come up with something else, you know, and say, well, it has definitive meaning, and like the teaching of Nagarjuna has provisional meaning, well, you have a problem then. I think that's why the Gelugpas didn't like the Chonangpas, you know, because it really challenged. It's not only, you know, like that you say, I prefer the Maitreya works and the Shantong, but they reinterpret it, you know, or they have their own hermeneutics for the whole Buddhist doctrine. Right. You know, and it includes also interpreting Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti in a particular way.
Yeah.
And that's completely opposed to what the Gelugpas are doing. You know? So that's one of the reasons why they locked up their texts, you know, and didn't allow them to be studied. You know?
Right.
So it's a bit tricky, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, like a month ago, I had an interview with my university here, and then they published, you know, like the interview on their homepage, and I had posted it on Facebook. And there was not a big, but a small shitstorm, you know, like coming from the Buddhist community, you know, like, oh, really? They didn't like, you know, that, oh, you can look at this in this way and that way, you know, like it's either provisional or definitive. And, you know, the Sakyas are doing that, the Gelugpas are doing that. And then you have the Mahamudra interpretation of it. And so, you know, like it's maybe not, you know, like easy for traditional Buddhists to take that.
Right. The debate is alive and well, then.
Well, very much alive.
Fascinating. Wonderful. So you have an ongoing project supported by the Austrian Science Fund.
We are investigating Buddha nature theory in the works of Mikyo Dorje. And so we just studied a selection of works from his Sungbum, from his collected works. And we have looked at the commentary on the Abhisamaya Alankara, which is very much Shantong, and like people say, it was influenced by his teacher Chöntrup Senge. He requested the Eighth Kamapa to write a Shantong commentary, and later, in the commentary on the Umalachupa or the Madhyamaka Avatara, he was critical more of Shakya Chokden and Chonan Pass, and so we just selected different commentaries and works by Mikyo Dorje, also tantric works, like the commentary on the Kusum Notre, the introduction in the Sri Kaya, in the Three Kayas, mm-hmm. a text by the third Kamapa, which was commended upon by the eighth Kamapa. And also what was very interesting is a review of Gyulotsava Shanupel and Shakya Chokden's tantric Buddha nature theories. Mm. And he is very critical, my God, I wouldn't have wished to be reviewed by Eighth Kamapa, he was really attacking them. So, looking at all these texts, we try to figure out, what his position is. And it is affirmative, he endorses, Buddha nature theory, but not the way the Chonangpas do it, you can talk about the nature of mind and pure pristine awareness without an ontological commitment. I mean, I can say, well, there is awareness, there is this original luminosity, without saying it exists independently or inherently. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And so it would be still a kind of dependently arising, phenomenon, mm-hmm. or continuity of awareness. But then you can say, well, this awareness, when you are realized, is empty of adventitious stains. Mm-hmm. They don't belong to it, mm-hmm. So the mind layers, which are influenced by ignorance, hatred, and so on, they are just, not belonging to this pristine awareness. So you can say, this awareness is empty of adventitious stains, but everything, including the pristine awareness, is rangtong. Mm. So this is a kind of moderate shantong, if you want, the theory, which is very nice in a way.
So the Eighth Karmapa kind of tried to make a little bit of moderate perspective after seeing previous.
He didn't make it moderate, but he follows, Maitripa and Sahasravatra, especially the Tattva Dashaka, the work by Maitripa, on the 10 verses of reality or on reality. And there is an extensive commentary by Maitripa's disciple Sahasravatra. And I have a paper ready, which investigated Mikyo Dorje's, reception of Maitripa's doctrine. Mm. And it is this combination of non-abiding Madhyamaka, which means not to superimpose anything, you just refrain from superimposing, because there is no valid model of reality, we have a theory about something, it's wrong. So all you can do, just stop having theories, stop superimposing, And this is the Madhyamaka part, this is the Gakchok, they call it in Tibetan, the part of negating, of refuting. Yeah. And then you have the Drupchok, of Saraha and Maitripa, mm-hmm. Who describe it positively, just as in Mahamudra also, Right. And this combination, is continued. It was received by Mikyo Dorje. It's a perfect continuation. It's something very traditional, He didn't make up something, It's he stands in this tradition, Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is what we have been working on the last 3 years, basically.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, we plan to, there are already some papers published, and a few more will come out soon, and we also plan a monograph together with David Higgins and Martina Drascik. And we have also a Kempo now working with us, a Trikong Kempo Tampel. He's originally from Ladakh. But you know, like,
Yes, I met him once. Yeah.
He was in Boulder yesterday, last year also. Yeah.
He
was in Boulder. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Attending this translation and transmission conference.
Right. Yeah. So will you'll continue to study Buddha nature in this way through the Eighth Karmapa's views?
Well, unfortunately, our project will come to an end this year. Mm. But I have applied for a new project. And it's also an unfortunate situation here in Vienna that once, you know, like postdocs have worked for you for 6 years, they cannot be employed anymore. So I cannot work with Tina and with David, which is very unfortunate because they are so experienced now and so good, you know. But I have a very good new student coming up, you know, like he will submit his thesis this year. And I applied a new project working on Shentong, on Chonang Shentong. You know, we are working on Dolpopa and his direct disciples. So we are just looking at, different works by Dolpopa and not only the sutra part, not only what has been done already many times, you know, not only the Maitreya works, but we want to look also at the Kalachakra material because it is said that Dolpopa gained his Shentong realization after a Kalachakra retreat and a lot of Shentong, of the Chonang Shentong, is based on tantric notions, you know, for example, like the Adi Buddha, you know, the primordial Buddha, you know, like a concept which is criticized, for example, in the Maitreya works, you know, in the Manasutra Alankara, it is said, well, you cannot have an Adi Buddha because that would mean that you can be a Buddha without the accumulation of merit and wisdom, you know, which doesn't make sense. But, you know, like in the Kalachakra, you have this concept of Adi Buddha and, you know, like also in Hevatra and others. And then, you know, like you have this this concept of the reflections of emptiness, the tongsuk, you know, when you like have non-conceptual realization, there are this like reflections or images, you know, like of a positively understood emptiness. And, you know, like this is compared to Namba Kunchok Dengi Tongpani, the all aspected emptiness or the emptiness endowed with all qualities or aspects. And this is taken by them as a proof that emptiness is not a mere nothingness, but is endowed with a lot of qualities. And so in other words, you know, the tantric part is very important for establishing the Shentong view of the Chonangpa. So we want to analyze that. But yeah. You know, I continue to be interested in the works of Mikyo Dorje and Ramchung Dorje. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, we have different projects here, and then sure. It's also good, you know, we are trying to establish a map, you know, like a philosophy map, you know, like a historical map, you know.
Oh, that's wonderful.
History. So we just try to figure out different systems and philosophies and see how they interacted. And yeah, so it's important. We consider it important, you know, to study also the Chonang works. And because everybody is only talking about them always, you know, they say, oh, the Chonangpas have this and that view. And that's wrong, of course, but nobody has ever looked at their texts, you know. Nobody has ever made an effort to go to Tsamtang in Eastern Tibet and meet the lamas, you know. There are a lot of very learned lamas in Eastern Tibet, and we met them and discussed with them. And so, you know, like the idea is, you know, like to just present, give Chonang Shentong a chance, you know, and read their own texts, you know.
Right.
And, let the campus, the Chonang campus, you know, explain the text, you know, and give them a chance to talk, you know, and present their position.
All right. Try to defend their position.
That's my next project, so to say. Yeah.
Amazing. That's wonderful. Yeah. So you were just talking about the link between Buddha nature and Tantra. And we wanted to ask you more about that. It's come up a lot, obviously. So the question is kind of, about that relationship, is tantric practice dependent on Buddha nature theory or Yogacara? And so in traditions where they don't accept that, or it's a provisional, you know, Buddha nature, for instance, is taught to be provisional, then how do they explain the path and the goal in terms of that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, of course. And I think I'm afraid I won't be able to like do justice to this question. But what I can say is, you know, like basically, you know, like you can like use like Yogacara or different systems, you know, of Madhyamaka. You can use Prasangika or Svatantrika or Niyakara or Sahakaravada of Yogacara to practice Tantra. So it works, you know, like also for Rangtong Pass, it works, you know, like for people who say ultimate reality is just a megak. And, you know, like Maitripa says, you know, in his Tattvaratnavali that like Tantra can't be practiced even on the basis of Yogacara, you know, so it can be, you know, like, but then, you know, like, I think, you know, like when you look at Mahamudra, you know, like the text by Maitripa and his disciples, you know, like what makes something tantric or what is a tantric approach? I think, you know, like it is like the possibility of directly realizing the true nature, you know, like of, you know, like having a direct realization of emptiness, similar to what you experience on the first bodhisattva level. And now, you know, like, how do you attain that? You know, like normally in ordinary Mahayana, you accumulate merit and wisdom for a long time, for a whole eon, and then finally you reach the first level. Or, you know, like you are having tantric empowerment and you're pointed out, you know, like in the fourth empowerment, the true nature, and then you can work with that, you know. And then, you know, like, or you have a mind-to-mind transmission and you have a direct realization, maybe similar to the one the guru has. And then, you know, like you would use positive language, you know, like Buddha nature and luminosity to communicate that. Mm. And so in this sense, you know, like Buddha nature, I think, you know, is an important tool to like transfer this direct realization of emptiness. It can be used this way, you know. Like, I mean, the whole third Dhamma chakra, you know, like also the Yogacara works, and they can be used as a skillful mean, you know, to communicate direct realization of the true nature of mind. And but then, you know, like you're always in constant danger of reifying and, you know, like of objectifying this. And so like that's why, you know, like people warn of it and prefer a prasangika approach, and they say, well, if you can't talk about it, better don't talk then, you know, let's just say emptiness and free from mental elaboration. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think the link with Tantra is that, you know, that it's a mean to communicate direct realization, and which makes a practice also tantric, you know, because this is how you get the shortcut, right? Because right. You have this direct experience, and you cultivate it either formally through like a generation stage or like a completion stage, or you can do this kind of, well, essence Mahamudra, or, you know, or like essence Mahamudra combined with a sutra. It's a sutra, but this is a sutra Mahamudra. This is very controversial, as you know, right?
Right.
It was very much attacked by the Sakyapas. And,
right.
So anyway, but I think this is a link, you know, like between the two. And it's nice to see also, you know, like how like this Amanasikara Mahamudra, the Mahamudra of non-mentation, yeah, is combined, you know, with the Maitreya works. Yeah. I mean, for example, in the Sikanya Disha, it is said that like he who is not like attached to the remedy and has no like idea of the reality and who like does not long for like the fruit, he finds Mahamudra. Mm-hmm. And you know, like when you look at the commentary by Ramapala, he quotes the Avikalpa Pravisha Dharani, which is a non-tantric like Dharani, a short like teaching by the Buddha, which teaches how you enter the non-conceptual. And, you know, like it says you abandon all the different characteristic signs, you know, the wrong imputations of duality, remedy, reality, and the goal by Amanasikara, by not becoming mentally engaged. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this links, you know, Mahamudra to this Avikalpa Pravesha Dharani. And, you know, like you have it in the Dhamma Dhammata Vibhaga, mm-hmm. you know, like, and there, you know, like non-conceptual wisdom is cultivated while you are abandoning all these wrong characteristic signs. Mm-hmm. And then, the Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga is considered to be a commentary on the Ratnagotravibhaga, on the Kulama. And so that you have this kind of connection, you know, to the Maitreya works. Mm-hmm. Besides that, you know, like Maitripa is also credited of having rediscovered the Kulama and Chöni Namche or Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga. So there's a very strong, I mean, there are many more points I could bring up, you know, like about the connection between the sutra or like the Buddha nature teaching, like by Maitreya, and the Tantric Mahamudra by Maitripa.
Right. There's a lot there. Fascinating.
Well, you know my book, you know, which I published in the Austrian Academy of Sciences,
mm-hmm.
A Fine Blend of Madhyamaka and Mahamudra.
Yes, yeah, we have that here. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's also, you know, like available now, like from the internet. I mean, the Austrian Academy has put it open access. So.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So,
yeah, so we can download it as well. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, exactly. So it can be easily spread also. I mean, it has a second part with all the critical editions, you know, like Sanskrit and Tibetan. But, you know, like you can just read the first part of the book, you know, like, so you don't need to be a specialist to read it. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe we can put a link to that on our website. That would be.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. For our readers to see more about that. So maybe we could switch gears a little bit and ask you some questions from the perspective of a general audience. Maybe think a little bit about answering kind of more simply or in terms of someone who might not know much about Buddhist studies or Tibetan Buddhism. So maybe you could, I know this is sort of a difficult question, but could you give us like a definition, a short explanation for a general audience? What is Buddha nature?
Well, I would say it's the presence of the sacred in the profane. So, you know, like how the divine, you know, can be in us. It's explaining you know, like how you can find, you know, like how there can be a direct path, a direct link, you know, to the divine in you. And this divine is not something abstract, but it's something very alive, you know. It's something you can experience, something very blissful and nice, you know. It's something real, you know, like you can access it.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a great definition.
I don't know. I try to avoid Tibetan and Sanskrit.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. That's an interesting question.
Can I push you on that a bit then? So is the divine different from the profane, or is it the same as the profane? Is it one way of looking at it? Is it purified, or is it just a separate thing altogether, like the Junongs would say?
Well, I prefer, you know, like what you find in the Maitreya works, you know, like where Buddha nature or Dhammata and Dharmas, you know, or like the profane, if you want, you know, like they are neither identical nor different, you know, kind of, I mean, the thing is, you know, like, I don't think that the profane and the sacred are exactly identical or like the same. Like, when you look at even Nagarjuna, when he says samsara is nirvana, you know,
right?
I don't think, you know, he means, you know, that samsara is exactly the same as nirvana. But when you look at the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas, it says, you know, like, the koti, you know, like the ultimate end, you know, the ultimate reality of samsara is the ultimate reality of nirvana. And I think there's a difference between samsara and the ultimate reality or nature of samsara. They are not exactly the same.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, like they are also not separate, you know. Like, look at, I mean, I always like this example of the rope and the snake, you know. I don't know whether you're familiar. You're in a tropical country and it's just about sunset, and you walk in the jungle, you see a coiled up rope, and it appears as a snake, and you are immediately scared because you know you're in a surrounding where are a lot of snakes or something, you know, like which really scares you, you know. So like you could say that like the snake and the rope, they're not the same, right? I mean, the rope is real, but the snake is a mere fantasy, you know. It's a mental product,
right.
Completely unreal. The snake cannot bite you, you know, like. So and but you know, like on the other side, you know, like where the rope is, there's also the snake. You know, the snake is not really in another place than the snake. It's the same thing, right? I mean, the rope appears as snake.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also identical, I mean, in a sense, you know, but not ontologically. Yeah.
Mm.
So it's neither, like, it comes down to saying it's neither different nor identical.
Right.
Just as you find it in the Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga, you know, like about Dhamma and Dhammata. Right. This is also what Mikyo Dorje often quotes, you know, like when it comes to the relation between the two. So that's like how he defines it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also the Chonangpas, you know, they follow this relation between the two truths, or Dhamma and Dhammata.
Hmm. Interesting. That's great. So another sort of more general question, could maybe you speak a little bit about who you think are the most important or influential people in the study of Buddha nature in Tibetan intellectual history?
Well, I mean, I like to divide, you know, like the group of scholars who didn't like Buddha nature and explain it away.
Yeah.
And then you have a group of scholars who somehow had a positive approach to it. And
uh-huh.
I mean, the first group, you know, like they studied with Nolo Rincherap, who was also the translator, Tibetan translator of the Gulama. Mm-hmm. And he had quite a few followers, you know, like... also Gyaltsab Che is very important, you know. He had written a very interesting commentary, like on the Gulama, like the disciple of Tsongkhapa. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something really important. And then, you know, like the Sakya, you know, like Sakya Pandita and Budan, you know, like how they interpret, you know, Buddha nature. That's also a quite interesting study, you know, of the whole doctrine. And I mentioned already the difference between the two approaches, so I don't like to repeat myself, but basically it comes to like explaining away Buddha nature, not taking it like seriously, so to say, you know, like it means, you know, like being a rangtongpa and following, you know, like the emptiness of inherent existence as the ultimate doctrine. And then, you know, like you have those who somehow like accept Buddha nature. And well, of course, you know, the first I have to mention Dolpopa Sherab Gyaltsen, who bases his whole like Shantong teaching and Chonang teaching on the Buddha nature doctrine. And he really takes it at face value, you know. And you know, he follows the original intent of the Tathagatagarbha sutras, the sutras which teach Buddha nature, and they really mean that you are already a fully developed Buddha, and you just have to like disclose this reality. You have to remove the adventitious stains so it shines forth. Yeah. And then, you know, like you have like also like in the Gulama passages, you know, which have Yogacara influences, which establish a small difference between Buddha nature and Buddhahood. Things still have to develop, you know. Like, for example, in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, you have the example of a destitute pure woman who has already the embryo, you know, like of a future monarch in her body. And the example is she's already on the safe side of life, but doesn't know it, you know, because she will be the mother of the future king. So she doesn't need to worry about anything. But, you know, like you could argue that, you know, like in this example, the embryo still has to grow, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a kind of potential, or there is some qualities there, but they have to blossom. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also a quite interesting interpretation. And this is maintained by Gulo Tsawa Shenupel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very nice commentary I published my study of Gulo Tsawa's Buddha Nature Interpretation by Wisdom Publications. And, you know, this is, I consider this a very, like, important, like, contribution, you know, to the whole discussion. And then, you know, like I would also like to mention Longchen Rabchampa, you know, and the Nyingma tradition, and like combine, you know, the Buddha nature teaching with Dzogchen teaching in a very nice way, you know, the primordial presence of Rigpa, and it fits very well, you know, with the Buddha nature thought. And this is also something I like very, very much. You know? Like, and also what comes after Longchen Rabchampa, you know, like Chumipam Rinpoche and, you know, other Nyingma masters. This is also something very special, I find. And I mean, I talked so much about Mikyo Dorje, of course, already, and Ranchung Dorje, and the Mahamudra tradition. And so that's why I didn't mention them now, you know. Like, I just, you know, assume that you already, like, know of the importance of the Kamapas and the Kakyu interpretation, Mahamudra interpretation. So on top of that, you know, like I mentioned a few more scholars,
Terms of the Karmapas, are there different Karmapas that significantly sort of change their perspective over time? I mean, does the third Karmapa and the eighth Karmapa have big differences, or?
I don't think so. You know, like that's like my personal view is that the eighth Karmapa's doctrine is very similar to what we find in the works of Rangchung Dorje. And, you know, like also, you know, like this statement, you know, that the eighth Karmapa wrote a Shantong commentary because his teacher, Chödrup Senge, told him to do so. I mean, come on, you know, like the head of a school, you know, like it's not told, you know, to write a commentary in a particular way, especially if it's already an accomplished scholar, you know. I mean, he was able to write a commentary of 1,400 pages, you know, on the Abhisamayalankara. So, so he was already very learned, and he must have known a lot. So come on, you know, like who is Chödrup Senge to tell him, you know, to write this, you know, like under like the viewpoint of Shantong, and even though he would have been a Rangtong or something. I don't take this very seriously, you know. Also, like he said, well, please write it, you know, according to the Shantong of the Chonangpas and Shakya Chogden. This doesn't make sense either, you know, because the Chonang Shantong and the Shakya Chogden Shantong doctrine, they are so different, you know. And I mean, there are so many like different points, you know. And like also when you look at the commentary on the Umala Chukpa, the Madhyamakavatara, he refutes Shakya Chogden and the Chonangpa separately. So he doesn't deal them, you know, like as one Shantong view, but he has different things to say, you know, to the Chonangpas and then to Shakya Chogden. And then, you know, like there are other like works like the Chachen Tribhum, Mahamudra collection of sayings, and systematic, also like systematically arranged. And you know, like there I take this text as very important to like finally, you know, like determine his view, Mikyo Dorje's view, because like he says, well, this like Rigpa, it's like when you draw a blade, you know, like which has no handle, like from wherever you touch it, you cut yourself, you know. So so the primordial awareness is like this blade, you know. It just cuts everything, you know. It cuts all like wrong superimpositions, you know. And you say, well, this like this blade, you know, like is a primordial awareness. It is Rangtong. It does not exist inherently, you know. It's Rangtong like anything else, but it is empty of other. It is empty of adventitious stains. Because like superimposition and wrong denial have no chance to survive with this blade, you know. It would cut them immediately. So this like awareness, this pristine awareness, is empty of that, you know. Like adventitious stains have no chance to survive, you know, there in this like original primordial awareness. So this is a nice way of Shantong, and I think this is what he, like, how he understands Shantong, and and then, you know, like in the same text, a few pages further down, he criticizes the Shantong of the Chonangpas. He says, well, you cannot say that like Buddha nature or the ultimate truly exists and is permanent and is a permanent entity. That's completely impossible. So like he does both, you know, like he gives a definition of Rangtong and Shantong, and he criticizes the Chonang Shantong. So like what I think is, you know, like that, like he didn't really change his mind, you know, like I mean, his Shantong position is moderate. And I mean, there might be small nuances, but I think, you know, like he maintained a moderate Shantung position right from the beginning. And he was critical of Shakya Chogden and the Chonangpas right from the beginning too. And this, you know, like corresponds very much to Rangchung Dorje, even though Rangchung Dorje does not use the word Shantung, you know, like, but, you know, like they quote similar texts and, you know, like have this relation between ultimate and relative as neither identical nor different. And, you know, like they are both using the Mana Sangraha, you know, like which says, well, you have the impure Alaya Vijnana and it cannot be the container of the seeds or the imprints of studying and practicing the Dharma, because, you know, this is what needs to be removed. But there is a Buddhahood which pervades you. And, you know, when you practice a Dharma, you store the seeds of this activity in the Buddha mind, which pervades you. And the two remain completely separate. Yeah, and it's compared to like mixing water and milk. And according to Indian tradition, you have it also in the Dhammadhatu Stotra, milk and water don't really mix. They remain separate. It's not very chemical, but this is what the Indians believe, you know. And the idea is that the Hansa, you know, the mythical goose, it can drink the milk and leave the water behind. So the idea, what you have is you have 100 white billiard balls, 100 black billiard balls, like well separated, one in the left side, the other in the right side, and then you shake the whole thing, and then, you know, black and white just mix up. But, you know, a white ball always remains white and a black ball always remains black. And so, like, the Alaya Vijnana, the impure mind, you know, always remains impure, and the pure always remains pure. So, and they are, like, this is a nice basis for Shantung, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because you have this separation, and both of them are using, you know, like, the Mana Sangraha. Mm-hmm. And, like for example, in the Sapmo Nangidön, you know, like, you have this example also, and in the auto commentary, there is just, you know, like a passage which talks about the two truths. So it was up to the third Karmapa to like decide what he quotes to explain the two truths. I mean, he could have quoted Nagarjuna, right, or Chandrakirti, or no, but he quotes Samana Sangraha, you know, and this nice example. So it shows, you know, like he likes his distinction, you know, like. And he likes his Yogacara approach of neither identical and nor different. And you can find the same thing also in Mikyo Dorje. And Mikyo Dorje calls it Shantung. So like indirectly, you know, like based on that, it makes sense to call Rangchung Dorje Shantung, but even though he's not. But it's this kind of moderate Shantung Pa, you know, like which you have in Mikyo Dorje. Right. And you have it like when you look, for example, at the seventh Karmapa, you know, like we don't have much. We have only this wonderful Rikshung Gyamtso, yeah, which is a big, huge commentary on the Pramana literature, you know, Pramana Vatika and Dignaga's Pramana Samuchaya. And also, you know, like the seventh Karmapa reads Shantung, you know, like in the final goal, you know, like the Pramana Pala, the fruit of valid cognition, is Rangrik, you know, is self-awareness and luminosity. And so he reads Shantung in this part also, you know. So like all fits very nicely, you know, together. And it's also not an ontological Shantung, because the self-awareness in the Pramana Vatika system is just a quality of mental events, you know, like it's just the ability to be aware of yourself. Each cognitive moment is also aware of itself. So it's a kind of continuity, you know, like it's a momentary thing. It's not something stable and ultimate and permanent, but it's like a continuity, a luminous continuity, so to say. And all that fits very nicely, you know. So it means it's still part of dependent arising. It's not completely out of like space and time and permanent and an entity. And but it's somehow, you know, like still part of this world, but dependently arising and empty of other, in the sense that adventitious stains don't belong to it. So yes, I think, you know, there is a continuity in the Karmapa's thought. I can see a continuity, you know. I mean, it's not exactly identical, but, you know, like, I mean, if you compare it to, for example, the Chonangpas, or if you compare it to Gulotsava, you can see like an identity or continuity in the thought of the Kamapas.
Great.
I'm going to publish a paper on that also, you know, like in...
Oh, great.
Yeah, we are bringing out a special volume on like Shentong.
Mm.
And I'm looking at these three Kamapas, you know, and show...
Oh, excellent.
They maintain a particular moderate form of Shentong, which is not ontologically problematic in a sense that they don't claim, you know, the ultimate inherent existence of some substantial permanent thing.
Yeah.
It's only it's a relational Shentong, you know, like it's, yeah.
And will that publication come out at the University of Vienna?
No, we are doing it with SUNY, State University of New York, yeah.
Oh, great.
Together with Michael Sheehy. And then,
excellent.
So, there will be a dozen papers on Shentong, yeah.
Oh, good.
Well, I hope to get it out soon, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, good. Oh, well, we look forward to seeing that. Fascinating. All right. So, one final question here. What do you think about the state of the field of Buddha nature studies in the West?
Well, I mean, there's a lot happening, you know, like there are conferences on Buddha nature and lots of important texts have been now edited and translated. And well, Carl did a great work, you know, like on Buddha nature and retranslating the whole commentary by Asanga. And so material is like available and, I mean, nowadays you can study really, you know, like the complexity of Buddha nature just based on English texts, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are already so many English translations. And so I think, you know, like it can like go out of this narrow circle of Indologists and Tibetologists. And I think, I hope, you know, it can be studied now also like in like more like religious department classes or philosophy classes. And well, I hope, you know, that we can somehow reach, you know, like other disciplines also, you know, like based on our translations, we hope that, you know, it will be more widely spread. Mm-hmm. So that's why I like your initiative, you know, because, you know, like why should I feel sorry to waste my time if I write a book just for 10 specialists, you know?
Yeah.
What a waste of time, you know? Like, I mean, of course, it's interesting, you know, like all the philology and like the special knowledge you acquire. But we should also be able to write in a way that, you know, like it can reach more like students and...
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope that we can support you in that in some way and support the community of people interested in Buddha nature doing this kind of work, because it's really fascinating.
Thank you for listening. Find out more about Buddha nature teachings at buddhanature.sadr.org. Sadr Foundation is a privately funded nonprofit trust established in New York City in the year 2000. We provide vital funding for the combined study and practice of Tibetan Buddhism in the West. Learn more about our scholarships and projects at www.sadr.org.